This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, starting with this stunning week in American presidential politics.
He was grabbing my breasts and trying to turn me towards him and kissing me, and his hands started going towards my knee and up my skirt.
These claims are all fabricated. They're pure fiction and they're outright lies. These events never, ever happened.
This is disgraceful. It is intolerable. And it doesn't matter what party you belong to, Democrat, Republican, Independent, no woman deserves to be treated this way. None of us deserves this kind of abuse.
Well, tape there from Jessica Leeds, one of the several women who this week accused Donald Trump of sexual assault. Trump vehemently denies every allegation, but he's been condemned by many, including First Lady Michelle Obama. You just heard her there campaigning for Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire yesterday. So we'll discuss the political implications of this week's news and much more in our Week in Review. And joining us today is Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of the Sunday Ideas section. Dante, it's good to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Shira Springer, Globe columnist on women's sport. Shira, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let me just get first thoughts from both of you about this wild and actually deeply disturbing week in presidential politics. Shira, first to you.
Where do you begin? I mean, I
don't even know.
Exactly. You know, I spent the evening sort of watching cable news, and it was sort of like a ticker going up trying to figure out just how many accusers there were for Donald Trump with regards to sexual harassment, sexual assault. Was it two? Was it four? Was it five? Was it seven? And the numbers kept climbing. But I felt better toward the end of the week, and this is all due to Michelle Obama. And, you know, I just thought what she had to say in New Hampshire yesterday and the way she put it and the fact that she did it with such authenticity was impressive and really put, I felt, Donald Trump in his place.
Well, since you mentioned the First Lady, let's listen to a little bit more of what she said in New Hampshire. Here it is.
It is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts. It's like that sick, sinking feeling you get when you're walking down the street minding your own business and some guy yells out vulgar words about your body. Or when you see that guy at work that stands just a little too close, stares a little too long, and makes you feel uncomfortable in your own skin.
Michelle Obama there speaking just yesterday in New Hampshire. I mean, Dante, I feel like the First Lady is absolutely reflecting and channeling a lot of sort of the fundamental, almost primal disgust that so many people are feeling this week about the election.
That's the thing. If this were not a kind of apocalyptic moment in our political cycle, it would also be an interesting, teachable moment, you know, I guess to certain men about the way that their actions are, you know, threatening to, you know, to a lot of women. You know, we've obviously been focused primarily on its political consequences this week. You know, I think Trump's protestations that these things never happened are somewhat contradicted by the fact that he was caught on this tape that broke about this time last week saying that he did precisely the type of thing that these accusers are now coming forth to say that he did.
Well, just to remind folks some of what he said, let's play a little of what the Access Hollywood tape from revealed last Friday by The Washington Post found Donald Trump saying back in 2005.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Every time I hear that, Dante, it's actually Billy Bush's laughter, which repulses me even more, to be honest.
I'm right there with you, Meghna.
Well, I mean, every single piece of what he just said, there has now been someone coming forward to say, oh, yeah, that specific thing that he said he did to me. He, you know, grabbed me in my private area. He forcibly kissed me. You know, he assumed that because he was a star, he was able to do it. You know, when they have you on tape saying that you do something, it is a reasonable presumption that somebody who says that you did that is probably accurate. It reminds me a little bit.
Can I just jump in here, though? I mean, in the defense of anyone who's been accused of anything, we should acknowledge that these are accusations so far. And I mean, the New York Times did say that the women that they spoke to. They spoke to several others around them whom the story had been told. But
I think the key, though, is there are several. We're not talking about one woman. We're not talking about two. We're talking about three, four, potentially five women, maybe more by this time. I don't know what the latest count is. That's one thing. And he impugned himself in the video. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, you know, there was I thought Michelle Obama's moment was a hopeful moment in all this. And the other moment, the sort of strike back moment that I enjoyed, was the New York Times lawyer and what he said with regard to to Trump threatening to sue the Times. He said, basically, you hung yourself by your own words. You have done exactly what you said you were going to do or would do.
And I think, you know, Meghna raises a good point. These are accusations. I will say, I think the reporting on this or on these, you know, on these accusers who have come forward has been pretty good, to the extent that they, you know, a lot of these accounts have been corroborated at the time by other.
And they coalesce in some ways in the details. I mean, there's a similar MO in the way that Donald Trump pursued the sexual assaults.
What it reminds me of a little bit was, you know, after the accusations came forward about Bill Cosby, the comedian, and about him, specifically about him, you know, being accused of drugging women or, you know, using intoxicants in order to take advantage of women. And then someone rolled back the tape a number of years and found an older stand-up routine in which he joked about this thing specifically. And it has that same ring of it, where the fact pattern that was in what was supposed to be locker room talk in the case of Trump, or you know, a mere stand-up routine in the case of Cosby, seems to be
what reality is.
Reality is, at least according to his accusers.
So I want to play a little bit more of how Donald Trump has been responding to the allegations and the reporting on his again alleged past actions. Here he is in Florida yesterday, lambasting the media and claiming that they are working in collusion with Hillary Clinton's campaign.
The corporate media in our country is no longer involved in journalism. They're a political special interest, no different than any lobbyist or other financial entity with a total political agenda. And the agenda is not for you, it's for themselves.
So Donald Trump has been bashing the media for virtually the entirety of his campaign. But let me ask you, I mean, to me, one of the deeper issues here that makes me just feel kind of a deep welling of disgust for our entire political system is Kellyanne Conway, who's managing Donald Trump's campaign, just this week, you know, tweeted about that all victims, alleged or confirmed victims of sexual assault, should receive the dignity of being believed, right? And then her own candidate is accused of sexually assaulting women, and the first thing they do is go out and vilify those victims. And this is the same campaign that offered up victims of Bill Clinton and was wanted to go so far as have them confront him at the presidential town hall debate on this weekend. So the point I'm getting to is that we are now in a political system where where both campaigns are flagrantly using, I'd say, the deep personal pain of individual women in this case for their own benefit, and it seems like shockingly commonplace, and it just disappoints me.
It's disappointing, but can I inject some hope here again?
Please.
and play off Dante's earlier comment about it would be great if this was a teachable moment. I think in some ways it is, in this sense, and one of the examples that comes to mind is the writer, I think it was Kelly Oxford, who said, please tweet me your sexual assaults, and, you know, with, I guess, I believe the hashtag, it's not okay. And I think in a span of something like 14 hours, she was getting 50 tweets about sexual assaults every minute. So I think if you can say on the plus side, there's a raising of awareness about what sexual assault is, about how men behave badly and that it's unacceptable. And there's a conversation welling up about this. And women are getting angry and speaking up and saying stuff and saying that it's not okay. Now, I don't think that's going to get through to Donald Trump, and it's not going to get through to his most ardent supporters, but it's starting a conversation that I think is important. And I think we're having it because of this political moment.
Dante?
You know, in terms of the, I mean, I don't think that this is necessarily a sign that the political system as a whole, you know, has irrevocably broken down. I mean, I think that this is
this is an unusual
moment of stress. I also think that these candidacies are a little bit unusual. I mean, I think, you know, we often talk about politicians saying and believing contradictory things at once. And
by the way, do you think Donald Trump really believes any of the stuff that he's espousing?
Well, who knows?
You know, the week after the election, he goes back and sort of to whatever life he has, and none of the issues that matter to him now matter then?
You know, George Orwell always talked, or in 1984, talked about this concept of doublethink, where you basically could believe two completely opposite things at the same time. And you know, this thing that, Magda, you were just talking about, you know, believe all women, or you know, believe all women who are not accusing the person on my side. I mean, those are unusually contradictory things to believe. I mean, people believe stuff that doesn't totally, you know, sync up all the time. But I mean, this is an unusual case where people are being asked to believe things that are directly contradictory. I will say, in the case of the Trump accusers, as we're saying, you know, I don't know that we should necessarily just reflexively believe anyone. You should look at the corroboration that comes up in the reporting.
Okay, so we haven't even touched on the political flip-flopping that's been going on all around the Republican Party this week because of what's been going on with the Trump campaign. Before we talk about that, I want to play a little bit of tape from someone we spoke to this week. Her name is Diana Ploss. She's volunteering full-time for the Trump campaign in Massachusetts. So she is absolutely part of the Trump base. And here's what she said about all the controversy regarding Trump and sexual assault.
I don't feel like he disrespected women having a private conversation with another guy. And let me tell you why. I'm over 50, and I have heard men talk like that and worse my whole adult life.
Okay, now whether you agree or disagree with her, I wanted to point to that piece of tape because I feel like right there is the reason why you have Paul Ryan saying, I am not going to defend Donald Trump, but I'm not withdrawing my endorsement either. You have all sorts of high-ranking members of the GOP first saying, nope, we step back from Trump, and then when seeing that he wasn't entirely damaged by the controversy, saying we're going back for him. I mean, it's this rock-solid base that I think that is really causing the long-term problem for the GOP.
The gymnastics that people have gone through this week on the Republican side are pretty amazing.
They're contortionists,
The contortions are amazing. When people on Saturday, a number of Republican elected officials withdrew their endorsement, some said that he should step aside. You know, part of that was I think that those people were genuinely appalled by what he said. I think it's also true that they felt like that was an opportune moment to do it, to do so, because Trump was losing. He performed or was seen as performing quite badly in the first debate. His numbers were tanking. So if you were a Republican elected official who was a little bit embarrassed to be associated with him to begin with, and you realized at that point, OK, he's probably not going to be the president and it's probably to my advantage to distance myself. So you get this sort of weird thing where people are trying
to hedging their bets.
Trying to calculate the exact amount of political courage to show, and it's a little bit of a sad spectacle.
Well, okay, so speaking of calculus or strategy amongst key members of the Republican Party, let me offer this to you.
I find a lot of what he says to be not only inappropriate, but outrageous and disgusting.
Of course, that's Governor Charlie Baker, and he has long said, up front, he is not going to vote for Donald Trump.
And he's a big distancer.
Right. And this is what he said yesterday. But here's what I'm wondering. I mean, in a way, like, Charlie Baker is perfectly positioned right now to become, I don't know, the future face of whatever Republicanism
remains. Yeah.
Right. Not Trumpism, obviously, but Republicanism. And I just don't know why he's still not coming out and actually not telling us who he is going to vote for. He's got 3 weeks left. I mean, what does he have to lose right now by saying I'm voting for X, whomever that might be?
I just think it's a question of he just does not want to get himself entangled. It's sort of you get caught in the brambles if you go in with Trump. I mean, I think it's the smart. It may not be satisfying to reporters, but I think it's the smart political move to just distance yourself and let Trump do his thing. And I don't know.
Really,
if
let me push back on that. Is it really a smart political move to say, I don't like that guy, but I'm not going to tell you who I think is best positioned to lead the country?
I mean, if you're a Republican and you're thinking of potentially having a future with this party, are you going to come out and say, hey, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton? I mean, if that's the
case.
Some
have.
I mean, I just don't think, I don't, maybe he doesn't strike me as somebody who's going to go out on the line out on
Dante,
a limb,
you want
rather.
To break this up?
You know, no, I mean, I just don't see him as that having that type of personality. Whereas, I mean, just comparatively, Kelly Ayotte, you know, which has been kind of impressive, you know, talk about what, I know you're rolling your eyes here, but she had that moment in the debate where she said, listen, you know, she was asked, you know, would you be a role model? And she stumbled with her answers, and, you know, and then she said, I would. And it made a horrible ad. And then she distanced herself. And she is now on record as saying, listen, I'm not going back like some of my Republican colleagues. I'm not going to flip flop. I'm going to stand on principle here. It may be coming late, but I'm going to. And if I lose the election because of it, I lose the election.
Dante, I'm going to come to you for a second, but let's hear New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte making the point exactly that Shira just reminded us of. Here she is on WCVB explaining how she's going to vote.
I cannot vote for Donald Trump based on what he said in those tapes and the actions he talks about in those tapes that talk about assault against women.
Okay, Dante, wherever you want to pick up there.
Where to begin? I think, in Baker's case, sure is right. I don't think that there's any real benefit to him. There's more of a benefit to him to just say, look, I'm not voting for Trump. This has got nothing to do to me with
sometimes
me.
Sometimes silence is best.
Sometimes silence is best. And I don't, I don't want to be involved in that way.
He's going high,
sometimes,
right?
Sometimes we also forget that Charlie Baker is, in fact, a Republican. You know, people around him say, no, he's not just, you know, this isn't just something that he's doing. He's a genuine Republican who's conservative and certain, but not always. And I think
he's a Massachusetts Republican.
That's why I think he's best positioned to lead them out of the wilderness.
But when we journalists are asking Republican politicians, specifically, would they vote for Hillary Clinton? You could imagine there being a Democratic nominee for president. I don't know who it is. Some reality show host, name your person, some disreputable character who gets nominated, Jerry Springer, and is running against someone like Ted Cruz, who for people on the left would be quite divisive and intolerable. And it's like, oh, would you vote for Jerry Springer or Ted Cruz? I mean, I think someone who was a genuine, committed liberal would look at that and say, look, I realize that Jerry Springer is completely unqualified to be president by experience, by temperament, and yet for me to say I'm going to vote for Ted Cruz would be something that person would find difficult.
It's a bridge too far.
Obviously, we could talk about presidential politics till November 8th, which, I mean, in a certain sense, we will be. But we've got a couple more stories that occurred this week and that do deserve some discussion. But let me ask you both. Let me just do my own little form of democracy here. Do you want to talk about Sal DeMasi or East Boston?
Sal DeMasi.
Two votes for the former Speaker of the Massachusetts House. Okay, so this is a different type of political story because federal prosecutors are asking a federal judge to release convicted former House Speaker Sal DeMasi. Of course, he's been in prison since 2008, since being found guilty of corruption charges. He's been diagnosed with stage 4 tongue cancer. He was diagnosed in 2012. And DeMasi's wife, Debbie, has said that the Federal Bureau of Prisons did not give him proper treatment. Now, here she is speaking to WGB about a year and a half ago about the chemotherapy treatment he first received when he was finally diagnosed.
He ended up getting quite sick and getting pneumonia from that, and I can't see where they ever treated him again. He was supposed to have 7 treatments of chemotherapy for his
But you discovered it yourself. They didn't tell you.
They didn't tell. No, and we're trying to get answers for that now.
And excuse me, I misspoke a little earlier. He's been in prison since 2011. Now, the Bureau of Prisons rarely approves requests for compassionate release. And following the decision, an inmate has no ability to appeal. But let me just ask you both, what do you make of this new request? And should DeMasi be released?
I think this is a... There is a case for, under certain guidelines, for older, ill prisoners to be released to the care of their family, partly out of compassion, partly because it's something that individual families can probably deal better with than the prison system. I guess I would say, DeMacy, as a once powerful politician, has people who can advocate for him in a very energetic way. I would hope that others, you know, other prisoners convicted of similar offenses would be eligible for the same type of treatment. You know, in this case, it seems like a pretty, at least to my eyes, a very good example of someone who, you know, should be eligible for release. I would hope that other prisoners in similar situations would get similar treatment.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly along the same lines as Dante. And it was interesting because as I was reading about Sal DeMacy's case, I was also reading about Ken Thompson's case. He was the Brooklyn DA who died of cancer recently, and he was a big, big advocate of revisiting questionable convictions down in Brooklyn. Mm. And he was sort of this crusading figure, and they expected great things from him, and cancer cut his life short. And I was thinking exactly about that, these two political figures, so to speak, thinking, I hope there are people out there who are in jail who have the same advocates that DeMacy has. You know, that he has an all-star group of lobbyists campaigning for him and getting his case in order, and you know, all these lawyers who are championing him and saying, you know, listen, he should be brought closer to home. He's dying. He's this. He's that. You know, you need to give this case attention. But there are lots of people both in a situation like DeMacy's, but also perhaps wrongly convicted out there that deserve the same kind of advocacy and attention, you know, that the same kind of advocacy and attention should be given to their cases as well.
And sort of as a general policy issue, there are, as prison sentences lengthened during the 1990s.
Overcrowding.
Overcrowding. I mean, there is a high incarceration rate in the United States. There are a lot of prisoners who are in for long sentences,
right.
And you know, I think we'll probably be hearing a lot more about this problem in cases other than Sal DeMacy.
I was going to say, I think we will, because wasn't it a few years ago when they actually changed the policy that allowed federal prisoners to apply for compassionate release after they'd served half of their prison sentence? And I think now it was an 8-year sentence for more than half. I think, you know,
eight-year sentence. Yeah.
And so he's somewhere around, what, 65% served of his sentence. And so he falls under these new guidelines, as do, I think, a lot of other prisoners who will now be applying for compassionate release.
Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. This is always an interesting turn to make, because these are the stories, hopefully a little more lighthearted, that didn't get as much attention as we think they should. And in a week like this, I'm really looking forward to our hubbubs. So, Shira, let's start with you.
Well, I'm going to turn toward the world of hockey. The Boston Bruins played the Columbus Blue Jackets in their season opener last night, and some of the locker room talk, I'm sure, was about as far away from anything Donald Trump could imagine. And that's because the two teams that played, before the two teams played, actually, Columbus team captain Nick Foligno made a $1 million donation to the two hospitals that saved his daughter's life.
Huh.
And one of those hospitals was Boston Children's. Foligno's daughter underwent successful surgery for a congenital heart defect at Children's when she was 3 weeks old. And now the donation that he's giving to the hospital will help fund research into cardiovascular disease in children and congenital heart defects. Initially, Foligno wanted to keep the gift private, but he decided that by going public, he would raise awareness.
Yep.
And the good news is that his daughter turns 3 years old today.
Yay! That's kind of locker room banter we can get
exactly,
behind, right?
Exactly.
Dante, your hubbub?
Boston City Hall has a terrible reputation, as most listeners of the show know,
as being
cold and bleak.
It's ugly.
I myself am a fan, but acknowledge that it could use some freshening up. Curbed Boston this week referred to it as a brutalist punching bag, being punched by people like Shira. But anyway, the city this week unveiled a new lighting scheme. There's 325 new LED lights that are capable of bathing it in multiple colors. For when I stopped by last night, it was pink for breast cancer awareness, but it can be green for St. Patrick's Day, rainbow colors for Pride Month, red, white, and blue for Red Sox championships, which presumably won't happen this year. But anyway,
presumably,
there will be lots of other festive occasions. I really like City Hall. I think that there's an undeserved bad reputation, but we can admit that the designers got not everything right, and therefore warming it up
a little bit
with some light is something that makes the entire area better.
Lipstick
off.
On a pin.
Any windswept concrete plane deserves a splash of color now and then.
Colorful and windswept.
All right. Well, my hubbub has to do with the Red Sox, sort of. Well, actually, not the Red Sox. With Red Sox fans, because this is by way of Mass Lawyers Weekly and Universal Hub, because apparently a federal appeals court has actually confirmed, we needed this to be confirmed by a court, that Red Sox fans can actually be fair-minded jurors, believe it or not. Because what happened was there was a case of a Rhode Island man who had been sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for a conspiracy to commit bank fraud. And it turns out that in his appeal, he said he didn't receive a fair trial because he believed that a lot of the jurors kept pointing to the fact that this was in Rhode Island, right? So it kept pointing to the fact that he had been wearing a Yankees cap. They identified him as wearing a Yankees cap, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, well, because it was in Rhode Island, the jury.
Through his trial?
While committing the crime?
References during counsel's cross examination testimony showed that he was wearing a Yankees cap. I guess witnesses saw him wear a Yankees cap. And this guy said, well, because the trial was in Rhode Island, presumably the jury had Red Sox fans on there. So the fact that they pointed out that he had a Yankees cap prejudiced them.
Yeah, but Rhode Island's a divided state.
I know, exactly.
Rhode Island is still Red Sox country.
But his appeal has now failed, and apparently a judge has said, nope, any Rhode Island jury, it doesn't matter who they're fans of, but they would not hold his wearing of a Yankees hat against him. So there. So Red Sox fans can be fair jurors. I'm glad we got that sorted out.
Well, you know that will come up again.
I know. Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist and editor for the Ideas section at the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Shira Springer, columnist on women's sports for the Globe as well. Thank you, Shira.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.